Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 160, Drunk with Wonder, June 27th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
In my own work with personal growth, I realized that the stories we are raised with, that the emotional traumas that we have, that we then come up with some kind of story to explain, usually involving something like, I'm wounded, therefore I am. That in order to truly heal out of that place, to move beyond and stop, in essence, being a victim, in other words, I'm wounded, therefore I act like a jerk. I'm wounded, therefore I treat my wife like crap. I'm wounded, therefore I speed and endanger people and drink excessively or what have you. When we stop doing all of those things and can just kind of go, wow, I had these stories, and I can really appreciate how my inner kid, my little kid, can really be terrified with all this stuff. And here and now, I'm not that little kid anymore. He lives inside me, but I can just pick him up and hold him and love him and soothe him, and I don't have to let him run the show anymore.
That was the voice of my guest, Steve Riles. The thesis of his new book, Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within, is that feelings fully felt shift. Through learning to be present to his own deep feelings, Riles was able to let go of years of addictive behavior, including freeing himself of decades of alcohol abuse 7 years ago. He attributes his current health and happiness to his direct experience that, quote, healing takes feeling, end quote, and says healthy sharing of feelings is key to a wonder-filled life. Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within is the culmination of years of research and decades of personal experience. It's been hailed as where conversations with God meets what the bleep do we know. Steve Riles lives off the electrical grid in Northern California, has a publishing company, was a music reviewer for years, has made and lost $1 million, and has been studying mind-body health his entire adult life. He's very knowledgeable about the interface between science and philosophy/religion, and his book is a compendium of the literature to date with an extensive bibliography combined with his own story of going from homeless and methadrine addicted to graduating from UC Berkeley on the Dean's List. Now, here's the interview. Steve Riles, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
Well, it's wonderful that we both can be here. We're both struggling against our own adversities. You've had a fire going up there, and I've been struggling with a summer cold, which, by contrast, is very minor. But tell me what's been going on in terms of the fire.
Well, there's actually multiple fires. There's the we have an extraordinary view where we live. Looks in the Mendocino County Mountains, we can see all the way to the ocean about 20 air miles away, so we can see a strip of ocean when it's clear. This morning it is so smoky, we cannot probably see more than a quarter of a mile. And these lightning strikes that happened Friday night and then even more strongly very early Saturday morning resulted in, I think they said, 60 fires in Mendocino County alone.
And oh my goodness.
What I heard on the news this morning is that most of them are under an acre, and there are only about 20 of them actually have people on them right now because resources are strained so thinly. The big fire that we're most concerned with right now is, I believe, called the Flint Creek Running Springs Fire, something like that, and it's at least 1,400 acres, and we do have some friends who have been evacuated, and they said they'd evacuated down in the Montgomery Woods or Springs area. And the people who are familiar with the area, the Montgomery Woods Redwood Reserve is just about 5 miles down Ore Springs Road from us. So we finally saw a great sight, which was a couple of the CAL FIRE bombers finally dropped some loads of retardant between us and the fire before sunset last night. And my wife took some before and after pictures, and you could really see a difference in terms of, you know, when those smoke plumes really start to build from the heat. And so this had laid down quite a bit. So supposedly the fire is going to be running south and west of us, kind of away from us. And so we were very close to evacuating. We had somebody that literally down the road from us who was ordered to evacuate, but they did not order us to. And
yes, when I spoke with you last night, you weren't sure about what you would be having to evacuate, and we weren't sure if we'd be able to speak this morning. And you told me that you've been working on the fire lines, actually, through the night.
Yes, my wife and I were called out. We're part of a community called Greenfield Ranch, and the ranch next to us is called Singley Ranch. And so we went out and worked with our neighbors and community on a fire line yesterday for about 3 hours, and felt like we had it fairly well contained. There were no CDF around at all. We were just all doing this. People had their own tools. Somebody brought in a pickup truck with a 300-gallon tank on it and a pump, and we ran hose all the way down this incredibly steep hill. And we're wailing away, and it established a fire line, and it seemed like we had it well in hand. And we went, we came back, and later yesterday evening they said that it had exploded. The wind had shifted, and the fire exploded out of that canyon. And so they were working all night long to establish a new fire line, which they think they have now. I mean, it's one of the local people just brought his bulldozer. You know, there's still no CDF there.
Wow, wow. Well,
so we're, yeah.
I certainly wish you well as this situation continues to unfold. And we're going to be talking today about your own spiritual journey and the book that you've recently brought out called Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within. And certainly when these kinds of external events happen in our lives, it can kind of put to test our spiritual stance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. As I was reading through your book, I was reminded of the folk song, I don't know if you ever heard it, Lonesome Traveler, which has a line, I think, that goes something like, I've traveled low and I've traveled high, and elsewhere, I've traveled rich and I've traveled poor. And I don't know if you've been a lonesome traveler, but clearly it's been quite a journey. It also put me in mind of the line from Amazing Grace that goes, I once was lost, but now I am found. So let's start from that place where you were down and lost. Your book actually starts out with you shooting speed back in 1968 at the age of 18. So tell us, how did you get there?
Well, I was raised in the 50s and 60s, like, you know, maybe all the boomers. And I had parents who blessed their hearts, doing the best they could, no emotional literacy skills at all, and I don't think anybody did to speak of back then. And frankly, I got raged on a lot, and I took that to mean, this is the Cliff Notes version, by the way, I took that to mean that there was something massively defective within me, massively broken, that mm-hmm. could not be fixed. And I learned very early how to distract myself from those kinds of feelings. First, it was reading. I was reading by the age of 4, and I did spend a lot of time alone, even though I was the oldest. I am the oldest of 5 boys. I was ridiculed in school. I was one of the geeks. I had to have glasses in the first grade, and, you know, wound up being the guy who was picked last for sports and overweight.
Oh, yeah.
Yada, yada. You know, that,
right.
that litany.
Yes.
And, when I got into junior high school, I was being bullied so much, and I broke, and I started smoking cigarettes, and I had a friend who was stealing them, and so that I could give packs of cigarettes out to the kids who'd been bullying me, and all of a sudden I stopped being bullied. So I thought, oh, this is cool. You know, I'll just go in this direction. So the direction that eventually led to was getting into drugs. And instead of fighting, because I've never been in a fight in my life, still haven't, at least not a physical one, I just went farther into the drug world. So that by the time I was 17, the kids at my high school who had been bullying me were coming to me for drug purchases. Mm-hmm. And so I was suddenly the cool kid.
Yes.
And so I went off in that direction, and I kept finding ways to look tougher in my own eyes. You know, I had an earring for the first time when I was 17 and was shooting drugs when I was 17, and this was considered, believe it or not, it was considered cool. I was also smoking cigarettes and so on and so forth. So I just spiraled down through that, basically suicidal, because I felt like my parents didn't care whether I lived or died. So that culminated in a night in a crash pad in Riverside, California, in April of 1968, when one of my best friends in the area where I had lived with my parents came to visit me and was disgusted and extremely angry at seeing me basically dying. I was very emaciated and, you know, so high. So I don't recommend this, to try this at home, kids, but he shoved a large dose of LSD down my throat and said, this is either going to kill you or cure you. Right now, I don't much care which. And stormed out. And so I went off on this amazing experience where I wound up literally having an out-of-body experience, which was quite a spiritual experience in itself, and looked down at my own body, and I was, oh my gosh, Carl's right. I am killing myself. So do I want to live or do I want to die? If I want to die, I can just go back down in my body, shoot a big dose of speed, and I'm out of here. And it was tempting. And I didn't, obviously. I came down instead on the side of living, and that was it for speed. That was it. I called my folks, and they came and got me the next day, and I moved back home.
Did I read that you actually heard a voice? I don't know if you experienced it as a voice outside yourself or within yourself or what, during that episode, that you heard some voice of sanity?
Yes. Well, in effect, it felt like, and I shrugged it off as, you know, I think everybody talks to themselves in a way. You know, you hear, oh, you should do this, oh, I don't want to do that, you know, kind of back and forth. I didn't really get it as a kind of a higher self or a larger, much more expansive self. And yes, I did. It was very clear that this voice was saying, well, you do have a choice. You can live or die. Mm-hmm. Do you want to live or die? Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted to live. So, I went back home. I reestablished connection with this friend who was back living with his parents as well. We had been roommates for a while. And 3 weeks later, he was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, my goodness.
Which sent me off, of course, in a whole other direction of not having any idea what to do with my feelings. And within a couple of months, I discovered the joy of alcohol and what a great numbing agent that is. And I proceeded to use alcohol as a numbing agent countless times for the next 33 years and quit almost 7.5 years ago now.
Yeah, you say you bathed yourself in alcohol for 33 years, avoiding the big questions as to your feelings of isolation and the meaning of life. And yet, and I guess during that same period, you went through a lot of major ups and downs. I saw in the bio in your book that you made and lost a lot of money. Maybe you can... We're all interested in money at some level, so tell us about your adventures.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I went from literally in my life, I have been homeless and was living on the streets in San Francisco in 1967. So I had that experience, and at one point in time, my former wife and I had a business. It's still in operation in Oakland. I haven't been part of it for a long time, but we were generating hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in income and had two nice homes and toys and trips and, you know, all that And I had the very clear experience of going from a graduate from UC Berkeley and dreaming of making $1,000 a month and thinking, oh, that'll be plenty of money. And then at one point in my life, we were grossing close to $20,000 a month, and it still wasn't enough because all of our bills had increased exponentially.
Sure.
And so I finally got off that train because I got it from personal experience that when we're looking for, when we're looking to make ourselves okay or good enough outside of ourselves, we're never going to get there because there's always something, somewhere else to go, something else to do, something else to buy, et cetera, et cetera. So I feel blessed that I've had that experience because now I know that there, you know, it does, it just, there's, that's a treadmill.
Yes,
and there's
right.
no end to it. And then when I quit drinking, I had, well, during my last years of drinking, we'd started an internet business. And when I quit drinking, I went, oh, this is all crashing. This is nuts. I've really been blowing it. And I went bankrupt. So I went from feeling really wealthy and having the trappings of success to having nothing in terms of physical, essentially physical assets, and found myself far happier actually in the last few years than I've been in my entire life. It's fascinating. Fascinating ride.
Yes. You can see why that folk song came to mind.
Sure.
I've traveled cold. I've traveled hungry. I've traveled up. I've traveled down. I can't remember all the words. But now, a key turning point came to you in the form of a hypnotherapy session with your friend Marilyn. Tell us about that.
Yes, that happened back in 1991. I had awakened out of a dream as the only dream that I can ever remember awakening from in which I was laughing when I woke up. It was such a joyous, amazing dream. And I was so fascinated by that my friend Marilyn had recently become a hypnotherapist. As I say, this was back in 91. And so I went to see her, and it turned out that she recorded the session, and she discovered through her own therapeutic means that there was a voice inside of me that wanted to talk, that was available to talk, and started a conversation with this voice and recorded it, as I said. And so we just went through a process of quite a few of those, and then I learned, became a basic hypnotherapist myself. Essentially all I did with it was learn to hypnotize myself so that I could bring this voice through. And that continued regularly until I quit drinking and then discovered that that I had been creating this sense of separation and that I was ready to start integrating this wisdom side of me, which is what came through in the book, so that I no longer have to say, oh, this, you know, my good side's out here somewhere in the heavens, and, you know, little old me is over here, and so on. I began to take that responsibility for being a much larger awareness. And I think everybody, frankly, has that capability. I don't think it's limited to me at all or limited to a few at all. I think it's inherent in every one of us.
That's fascinating. Initially, those first hypnotic sessions, I gather you had no recollection for what you said, and that you, when she read these transcripts back to you, there was a shock of, boy, where is this coming from?
Well, shock and fear.
And fear.
I remember distinctly the evening of that first session, getting pretty drunk and stoned, just sitting there kind of really, boy, the guys in the white coats are going to be coming for me now. I would just, you know, had been going through a spiritual growth process. There's a lot of books, like many people, the Seth material and different things that were popular in the 70s and so on, and the 80s. And I was fascinated by all this material, but I kind of poo-pooed it at the same time. Oh, come on, you know. I, you know, really came out of a non-Christian, Unitarian Universalist, very rational background, humanistic, okay, rational background with no real sense of spirit. And so it was a long, I mean, 20 years ago, I would not utter the word God. I would not use it at all. So it's been quite a long ride. And at this point in time, I am, you know, I feel like when I'm talking to you, David, about these stories, it's really is almost as though I'm talking about someone else.
Sure. I know that feeling. Sometimes when I look at my own past, I feel like I'm telling a story, you know, about somebody else that I barely feel any connection to. I was intrigued by what you were saying a little bit earlier about the integration of this, and you mentioned the Seth materials. And so there are all these books that came out during the 70s and since of, you know, what's called channeled wisdom, where there's some entity in some other dimension or plane or reincarnated or something that's channeling this information. Do I understand you correctly to say that you might have seen it in that light initially, but that you're seeing it in a somewhat different light now?
Yeah, very much so. Yes, I had it set up. I had my story, if you will, set up that I'm channeling this being named Arondaho, and that's what he called himself. And it was popular for people to come and have sessions with Arondaho, and we recorded them and gave them this, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so that was the language that I used. That was the best language I had, was that this was this other entity out there somewhere. I've since become much more interested in non-dual awareness and letting go of stories that separate, of duality, whenever I can. So I'm reminded of Marianne Williamson's famous quote that was at first attributed, I think, to Nelson Mandela. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. Mm-hmm. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. So that is where I have come to in my own integration, is that I decided that I needed to step into this far larger presence and awareness and stop being a victim, stop making other people or institutions wrong, making them to blame for my experience in the world, and begin to just take mastery of what do I choose in this moment.
Yes.
And if something's going on that isn't working for me, instead of blaming someone else, which is so easy to do, I just am able sooner or later, not always immediately, to stop and go, okay, I need to take ownership of this and make another choice. And do it with love and compassion and kindness and create the life of my dreams, which I have far more of the life of my dreams than I could have imagined possible when this whole thing started.
Yeah, well, that's really wonderful. You found that embracing your, I was intrigued that you found embracing your higher self to be somewhat of a mixed bag in terms of your ability to come to terms with it and not feel like you were losing your mind.
Well, you know, we have these stories that we grow up with. We certainly have many different ways of languaging this. I liken it to, in the book, I liken it to the pearl in that an oyster grows to shelter itself from a grain of sand. You know, it uses calcium carbonate, I think, to create this beautiful opalescent pearl that people find extremely valuable. And so they pull it out of an oyster and they pull it up, can you know, hold it in their thumb and their forefinger. Isn't this a beautiful pearl? Now, it would be perfect as soon as I get a drill and drill out the grain of sand. Then it'll be fine. No, we don't do that. And so in my own work with personal growth, I realized that the stories we are raised with, that the emotional traumas that we have, that we then come up with some kind of story to explain, usually involving something like, I'm wounded, therefore I am. That in order to truly heal out of that place, to move beyond and stop, in essence, being a victim, in other words, I'm wounded, therefore I act like a jerk. I'm wounded, therefore I treat my wife like crap. I'm wounded, therefore I speed and endanger people and drink excessively or what have you. When we stop doing all of those things and can just kind of go, wow, I had these stories, and I can really appreciate how my inner kid, my little kid, can really be terrified with all this stuff. And here and now, I'm not that little kid anymore. He lives inside me, but I can just pick him up and hold him and love him and soothe him, and I don't have to let him run the show anymore. But there's a sense of grieving in that. There's a sense of dying to our old stories. And that's a non-trivial, and I'm sure you'll agree, David, that's a non-trivial thing to do. And it scares a lot of people to death to even think about letting go of these stories of who we thought we were in order to grow into more of the full possibility of expression. In my own work with personal growth, I realized that the stories we are raised with, that the emotional traumas that we have, that we then come up with some kind of story to explain, usually involving something like, I'm wounded, therefore I am, that in order to truly heal out of that place, to move beyond and stop, in essence, being a victim. In other words, I'm wounded, therefore I act like a jerk. I'm wounded, therefore I treat my wife like crap. I'm wounded, therefore I speed and endanger people and drink excessively or what have you. When we stop doing all of those things and can just kind of go, wow, I had these stories, and I can really appreciate how my inner kid, my little kid, can really be terrified with all this stuff. And here and now, I'm not that little kid anymore. He lives inside me, but I can just pick him up and hold him and love him and soothe him, and I don't have to let him run the show anymore. So most of the fear, most of the time in our culture, is emotional in nature, and at least the way I see it, and specifically afraid of feeling our emotions, because when we don't have any skills or any models for how to do feelings in a healthy and responsible way, and I want to emphasize healthy and responsible, we wind up leaking out our full, you know, our full balloons, as we call them in an organization I'm involved with called Challenge Day, and we leak them out on people who are closest to us. We leak them out in school shootings. We leak them out in, you know, or pop them, really, in suicides. And, you know, two of the leading causes of death in teens is suicide and murder. And then accidents, you know, and drinking to excess and causing accidents and so on. And these, all of these can be correlated directly down to the same issue, which is that people feel isolated and separate and alone, and they don't have anybody that they feel safe in talking to about their feelings. They don't have any models about how to talk about their feelings, what feelings they even have. And so we have an intoxicated, inebriated society that's devoted to distracting itself from what's really going on inside. Of course, that makes a great populace for instilling fear and politicians getting elected based on scaring the holy heck out of people.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that going on these days.
Yeah. And then, of course, the other side of that is that if we as a culture can convince the people who live in the culture that they're not good enough in and of themselves, then we can keep selling them things. And telling them that if only you buy this, or if you have this car, or this house, or this job, or these clothes, or this perfume, this jewelry, this kind of a trophy wife or trophy husband, then you'll be good enough. And of course, as we talked about earlier in the show, when we're looking outside of ourselves to be good enough, you know, we're always looking for something else.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you even talk about that we're biologically programmed for fear. I think you make some reference to the amygdala and so on. A lot of interest in the brain these days. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, some of the latest brain research, which I'm fascinated by, is that scientists, researchers have mapped out the five most primal emotions down right into the reptilian brain. And these are activated by the amygdala. And that is fear, which the full-blown version is panic, anger, the full-blown version is rage, there's separation anxiety, think of a kid going to school for the first day, there's lust, of course, for procreation, and perhaps the most fascinating one that people are really unaware of is seeking behavior. There's that kind of seeking behavior that will have people go, I wonder what's over that mountain. I wonder what's over that ridge. What's going on over there? Mm-hmm. And that's down below our mammalian brain, because we kind of have a triune brain. The reptilian brain sits on the brain stem, and then the mammalian brain pretty much surrounds that. And then we have the prefrontal cortex and our thinking language centers and so on that are the most recent addition. But one of the things I found most fascinating, David, is that there aren't a lot of really big, kind of like super highways of neurons between these various parts of our brains. They're relatively independent. I mean, we can have extremely serious brain damage to where we're in a vegetative or coma state. But if the reptilian brain is still functioning normally, the body will still ingest or is capable of ingesting nutrition and releasing toxins and waste and breathing and the heart beating and so on and so forth. It's completely outside of our what we call our conscious awareness. So when I talk about these really basic emotions of being programmed for fear, we're programmed to survive long enough to procreate.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're, you know, you imagine being in a imagine being in a jungle somewhere, for example, and there's that low cough from a big cat that you hear right behind you. So you want to be up a tree really quickly.
Right.
You don't want to stop and go, gosh, I wonder if I should be worried about that.
Yeah.
Because about that time, you're dinner. And so we are programmed, and both our visual neuronal pathways, the visual, my brain's having a senior moment here, but these big neuronal pathways that go from our visuals and go from our hearing bypass our higher reasoning. They have these activate through the amygdala into our body and have the body react in very powerful and very fast ways because we don't have time to think about it. When you imagine jumping out of the way of a car, if you stepped off a curb, that's something I think many people have experienced. So what I'm saying here is that there is a fear response that is entirely appropriate, even though we don't need it very often these days. And of course, one of the things that happens when we get scared is we have a tremendous surge of adrenaline. And that's, I think most people would agree, that's a rush. Well, when you're shooting drugs, that's a rush.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really going for the rush. And many, I think perhaps almost every single person on the planet is addicted to adrenaline at one level or another. And so we have these different ways that people get their adrenaline fix, and many of those ways I find completely foreign, like jumping out of an airplane or watching horror movies, you know, fill in the blank. But
yes.
I have my own ways to get my adrenaline fix, and one of them is being interviewed, for example,
right.
And talking about my feelings and getting real. That to me is endlessly fascinating and endlessly exciting. And you know, one of my favorite sayings, David, is that fear is excitement without breath.
Fear is excitement without breath.
So if you find yourself afraid,
yes.
And you're not being chased by a big cat, for example,
mm-hmm.
but you're just anxious about something,
yes.
Try breathing. Try consciously stopping whatever you're doing. Stop the doing for a moment and just take a deep breath and breathe into the fear.
Yeah,
Yeah. And you'll notice your heart rate start to drop, and you'll notice things start to change physiologically, because when we get fearful and we're not aware of it, our breathing gets very shallow and fast, and it's really hard to think clearly.
Yes, yes. And I find bringing myself into the present to be very helpful, because often that fear response for me is about some anticipated thing that's in the future but that isn't really here at this moment.
That's very true, and I talk about that extensively in Drunk with Wonder, where I really strongly, you asked earlier, how do we get past this fear? How do we start getting farther down our road of consciousness? And it is by, I don't know any way to do this other than by some form of mindfulness meditation, mm-hmm. or becoming present, which for me, meditation has been that tool over and over again for almost, 28 years now. And that involves, for me, it involves breathing and becoming aware of my thoughts and becoming aware that I am not any of my thoughts and allowing the thoughts to come and go and continuing to breathe and be present as I can. When I notice that I'm lost in a thought again, I just gently let that thought go and come back to the present moment.
Right.
And do that for years, and it really, it's made an enormous difference in my life.
Yes. Let's talk about love a bit, because I think you do talk about love as one way of counteracting this sort of fear-based consciousness that we have.
Sure. Well, my personal experience is that love and life are the ultimate gifts of the animating presence of the universe, however you wish to language that. And I do personally experience the universe as not random. I think that's the kind of the core that I've been able to come to in terms of basic life questions. Is the universe random? Is life just random? Or is there some organizing principle of some kind behind it? And I've just had to come down on the side of there's some organizing principle. If you study the Earth, study Gaia, and study the way that this planet has been able to keep a rough equilibrium that allows life to flourish even with monstrous meteorite impacts, asteroid impacts over the millennia, I don't think it's random. I think every day we're seeing new discoveries of more and more planets. They just had an announcement the other day that now that they've got better instrumentation, they're seeing way more planets, and they just know they're coming very close to finding more and more Earth-like planets that are capable of supporting life. So I think life is all over the universe, and I think that that pure unconditional love, which I believe is the animating principle of the universe, that it's the greatest gift that pure unconditional love could possibly give is life itself, the opportunity to experience love for one another. So you want to choose love over fear? Again, you have to be present. You have to be willing to find a way for you that works for you to become present into the moment, because that's the only time we ever have, if you will, to make a choice, mm-hmm. love or fear.
Yes.
You can't do it in the past. You can't do it in the future. You can only do it right now. In this moment, I choose love.
Choice,
in this moment.
Yeah, choice is like a key doorway. And I noticed that you put a fair amount of emphasis on choice. I'm very interested in that.
Yes, choice becomes available when we are able to step out of the stories. We spoke earlier in the program about being stuck in our stories of fear and lack, stuck in I'm not good enough, stuck in some kind of a victim story that somebody else is responsible for my experience, therefore I'm helpless, there's nothing I can do. You know, if we have to be willing to do the practice, do the work, so that we can become present and step out of that story, realize I am not my stories. So once we're able to do that, we can begin to make choices. As long as we're, and I know this may sound jargony, but as long as we're thrown to the stories we grew up with, there's a level in which we're running a program, like a computer. We're not able to make conscious choices outside of the context of that program. So if we're tired of the program we've been running, and we realize that, then we have the opportunity to make different choices and change our lives radically, like quit drinking or quit smoking or get out of a relationship that isn't working anymore, or throw open the doors of our heart and invite in the relationship of our dreams, invite in the career of our dreams, or what have you.
Yeah. You know, there's so many personal growth, self-help, spiritual books out there. What drove you to write this book? I mean, a book takes a lot of work, a lot of effort, a lot of time. What drove you to produce this?
Well, David, I feel like I have been gifted with a specific piece of the puzzle that I needed to move me along my path. And I realize and deeply honor and respect that there are so many different paths and so many different ways that people can kind of wake up to taking on more of who they really are and stepping into a world where we can become our own heroes. And for me, the piece that I feel has been missing from the Eastern philosophy, because I really appreciate Buddhism a lot, and I appreciate a lot of Hindu thought, and my heart really connects with a lot of that, and a lot of the shamanistic teachings, the earth teachings, paganism, all that kind of stuff. I take bits and pieces from that, and mm-hmm. I put them in the book. The piece that I have felt was missing is that, largely missing, is that instead of treating the ego as a problem to be solved, or in some cases people are extreme enough to say we need to kill the ego, in essence.
Yes.
We need to get rid of it completely.
Yes.
My belief is that that's like drilling into the pearl to pull out the grain of sand.
Uh-huh.
I think it's missing the point completely. I think that particularly in our culture where we are actively engaged in the world, and I'm, you know, so socially progressive and want a sustainable future for my granddaughter and so on, we've got to take action. And in order to take action, we've got to be willing to embrace these old stories, but then not let them run us anymore. By becoming present and becoming aware that they're stories, they're not the literal truth, and that we can tell different stories. First, we have to know that we can do it, and then we have to be willing to invent the stories. So the piece in the book that I think, I've had hundreds of comments about this, literally, that I'm giving people is an opportunity to see how when we are lost in our emotions, or specifically lost in trying to keep ourselves from feeling feelings that are scary or threatening, because we've never had a model of realizing that any feeling fully felt shifts. In other words, we spend all our time, so many of us spend all of our passion and all of our, so much of who we are and our energy trying to keep ourselves, keep the feelings walled away, you know, keep them locked away. When if we were able to learn how to feel them in healthy and responsible ways, that all that pent-up energy would just flood through us and dissipate, and then that passion for life would be available to us again. And one of the astonishing things about going through this process of feeling our feelings, and I keep emphasizing in healthy and responsible ways, is that we can think more clearly. It's an amazing thing, but really the bottom line is that we're able to think more clearly. We're able to be present in the moment because we're not sitting on this tsunami of unfelt feelings.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, there's so much more that we could talk about and that we haven't touched upon in your book. We could go on quite a bit longer. For example, you've got an interest in quantum physics, and we really don't have time to go into that and talk about that. I think there's a lot about what you've written here that I personally really resonate with, and that I could have easily been turned off. I have difficulty with channeled books and so on, but I find there's a balance and a humility in the way that you come across and what you've written here. I like the title of your book, Drunk with Wonder. It reminds me of the Sufi poet Rumi, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Well, that's where I got the idea.
Oh,
frankly.
Okay. Yeah. His
Rumi
work,
and Hafez.
Yeah. And their work embodies that sort of passion. And you spent many years addicted to drugs and alcohol. And I think many times people who become addicted to various substances are doing so out of their hunger for transcendence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And absolutely. I read Hafez or I read Rumi, and they bring me to tears. Mm. And the tears of wonder. Mm-hmm. When I say drunk with wonder, I really literally want to be provocative in the sense that I believe and experience that the most amazing intoxicated experience I ever had in my life has been easily overshadowed by my being drunk with spirit and being intoxicated with having deep, intimate, loving, caring connections with people. And just walking out and seeing the most astonishing sunset is incredibly intoxicating to me.
Steve, that's a wonderful place for us to close. I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure to be with you, and I'd be happy to come back on and talk about quantum physics or anything else you'd like sometime.
I hope you found some inspiration in this conversation with my guest, Steve Riles. As I think you probably heard me say, I personally find it hard to endorse books that revolve around conversations with channeled entities. It's just a personal failing of mine. I'm not sure what to make of them. My own best guess is that they are somehow productions of that person's unconscious, or perhaps of a collective unconscious. But ultimately, it's a bit of a mystery. I think there's always the lurking danger of ego inflation and cultism surrounding such works. Steve is an interesting exception to me. I guess we heard that in the fact that he was working for a time channeling an entity that he experienced as outside himself. However, in his personal evolution, he's come to accept a larger view of himself, that he and all the rest of us are an expression of the divine. His book is cast more as a conversation with his higher self than with some outside entity. And as he tells his own story, there's a down-to-earth quality and a humility that comes through that serves to increase my own level of trust. Beyond this, I'm impressed that Steve's spirituality is not just an ethereal one, removed from the issues of the day. I'm impressed that he's taking seriously the threat of global warming and has taken concrete steps in his own life to get off the grid. I spoke to him about this after the formal interview was over. And part of what he said to me was, and I'll quote, "It's consciousness 101. Of course we recycle. Of course we reduce our carbon footprint. Of course, if we possibly can, we live off the grid and just tone way, way down what we're doing on that basis. And we eat organic foods and we have our garden. To me, those are all kinds of givens, just like I made sure the book was printed on recycled paper with soy ink. In other words, living it rather than just yakking about it. The only kind of leadership I appreciate is exemplary leadership, where people are leading by doing." End quote. So given that kind of example, I have to say, lead on, Brother Steve, lead on.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind.
It's been some time since I played that whole song, and to me it felt really in keeping with this interview with Steve Riles. That jingle, along with my others, was set to music by Jeff Smith, and Jeff is spelled G-E-O-F-F, and he's just brought out a new CD called Ones and O's, and you can get it at his website, which you'll find at www.thejeffsmith.com. And he's put the title track on the PodSafe Music Network, and I'm going to play it at the end of today's show instead of our usual fade-out music. It's been a long time since I've ended with a vocal, and so it's about time. But more importantly, I want to pay tribute to Jeff and all the fine work he's done for so many of us podcasters. If you're not, if this idea of me playing some music like this at the end of the show is a new one to you, then you haven't listened to our archive shows, because that was a practice for about the first year of this podcast, and then I finally stopped doing it. But I really used to get a kick out of trying to find just the perfect song to match the content of the show. And for me, that was part of the fun of it. But I heard from enough people that, you know, that their musical taste wasn't the same as mine, so I kind of let that go for the most part. Now, be sure to catch Shrink Wrap Radio Live number 10 tomorrow morning, which is Saturday, June 28th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. You can participate live with us by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio, and you'll be able to call us on the phone number that you'll see there, or to join in on the web chat. I hope you'll be there. Among other things, my friend Jerry Trumbull and I will be discussing an article that appeared in The Atlantic about the impact of Google and other digital media on the brain. And let me remind you about my other podcast at www.wisecounselpodcast.com, where currently you'll find my interview with Dr. Michelle Kraske, who is a world-class researcher on anxiety and its treatment. And once again, I want to thank everyone who's made a PayPal donation through our Top Spots widget on the site. Be sure to check out the links of those donors, and please do consider making a $20 donation yourself in exchange for the opportunity to promote your favorite blog or website there. Just go to shrinkwrapradio.com and look at the top right-hand side of the page. And speaking of blogs and so on, seems like our number of subscribers is drifting down again. I don't know why that happens. We'll get a mention somewhere, and it'll surge up, and then it'll drop down again. So please do remember to promote Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, your colleagues, your fellow students. We actually have promo materials on the site under the promos menu, where you can print out flyers to hang in laundromats and put on bulletin boards and places like that to kind of help get the word out. Because, you know, we thrive on having an audience. What more can I say? Our list of interview transcripts continues to grow. I mean, I've stopped trying to count. It's so long. And I have to say, most of the work, almost all of it, has been done by two two stalwart volunteers, Joe Kelly and Susan Argyalin. So help them out. Geez, they're carrying a lot of work here. Just drop me an email if you'd like to help out in that way. The sponsors for this show, as always, are Mevio and GoDaddy. Check out all of our GoDaddy discount codes on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. For example, using the code SHRINK3 at checkout will get you a 10% discount on any domain names you purchase.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Sarah Cutter Radcliffe from Toronto. You have two fantastic shows, Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio, but I just want you to know that one of the reasons why I like Shrink Wrap Radio the best is because of that really funky music you play. I just love it. In fact, I wouldn't mind a whole album of it to play whenever I wanted to cheer myself up. So please keep that music coming and keep our toes tapping there. Thank you so much, Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Sarah. I'm not sure which funky music you're referring to, but I took it to mean the Jeff Smith collaborations that I mentioned earlier. I wrote the words and he created the music, so it was this message that prompted me to play the long version of today's jingle, actually. And perhaps your wishes come true with a whole new CD of Jeff Smith music just now coming out. And Sarah, your message inspired me to wake up in the middle of the night and write out some words for a new jingle idea that I have, kind of in a different genre than the current ones. I've sent off a query to Jeff, but I haven't heard back from him yet. He may be getting so famous and busy as to be out of my reach, but I hope not. Now for some written listener emails. First, we hear from Hans in the Netherlands, who writes, "I'm still catching up backwards and forwards on your endeavor. I am at number 119 on the upper side and started to look back at the 2005 podcasts." And he goes on to talk about that he seemed to discover a problem in the 2005 feed. Now, to me, it looks okay, and I haven't heard any reports from anybody else about such problems. But if you do encounter problems with any of the feeds, let me know. Let's see, he says, "In the latest podcast, I heard you were asking about somebody to help you with the logos for a t-shirt. Well, yes, you are listening to some back podcasts." That has been solved, because he goes on to ask, "Is that sorted out yet by now? Otherwise, let me know. Maybe I can be of help." So thanks so much for that offer, Hans. The issue with the t-shirts has not been the design of the logo, but actually getting anybody to buy any of them. I'm not aware of anybody having bought any of those t-shirts. Not that I make any money on them, but I thought it would be great advertising to have people out there in the world wearing the t-shirts. Hey, if you've bought one, let me know, okay? And not just Hans, but anybody out there. And next we hear from Paul in Shropshire, England. I think we've heard from Paul before. He says, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've really been enjoying both of your wonderful podcasts. They've been of great help in broadening my knowledge of psychology. I've particularly enjoyed your interviews with leading therapists. As a therapist myself, I've picked up many new ideas and new places to look. It's great to hear from the originator of these various methods. I was thinking it would be good if you could interview some more psychologists from the UK, as we're often in the shadow of our American counterparts. I could particularly recommend Dr. Nick Bayless, author of Learning from Wonderful Lives. He's a positive psychology lecturer at Cambridge and also an Ericksonian hypnotherapist." Well, he does sound very interesting. I hope to follow up on this suggestion. "Also, Professor Guy Claxton at Bristol University, author of Hare-Brain Tortoise Mind, an expert in learning, creativity, and the interface between Buddhism and modern psychology. Anyway, thanks for all of your efforts. Kind regards, Paul in Shropshire." Well, Paul, both of those recommendations sound like just my cup of tea, so I'll try to follow up on them. I do have quite a long list of suggested guests and ideas of my own, but hey, we've got lots of time, right? And eventually, hopefully, we'll work our way to all of these wonderful ideas. You know, when I first started doing the podcasts, I had thought that I would just be starting off with people that I know, and it's amazing how wide and how quickly and how widely that net has spread out. I can't keep up with it. I can't keep up with myself. And then we hear from Susan, one of our two super transcribers who I mentioned earlier. And Susan writes, and this was in response to a self-deprecating comment of mine about thanking her for her interest in transcribing the conversations between Jerry Trumbull and myself. You know, we're not famous. Why transcribe us? And she wrote, "Hi, David. I really value the conversations you and Jerry have for their humanity, candor, insight, and great information. I've also had a strong feeling that NPR, American Public Media, or Public Radio International might be interested in carrying your show if you so desired." Let me just parenthetically say, yes, I would love to be on NPR. To me, they're the gold standard, but I don't have any connections. I did enter a contest a year or two ago for podcasters to get a show on there, and didn't seem to qualify. But if there's a listener out there who can help us make that transition, and when I say transition, it wouldn't be instead of this, because I'll never give this up. It would just be an addition to. But I've heard from a number of listeners that they think we're worthy enough to be on the regular airwaves. So if you've got any connections to help that happen, I don't have enough time, energy, or hustle to really pursue it in terms of marketing it really hard. Let's see. Susan goes on to say, "I wonder if you're familiar with a show called The Infinite Mind. It's that program in particular that leads me to believe that there could be a real market out there for shrink wrap radio. You're such a marvelous interviewer. You ask the very questions that are on your listeners' minds when they hear your guests. You also give them plenty of space, lots of breathing room, which is refreshing. I can't think of any program as diverse and inclusive as yours when it comes to guest selection, too. Guess that's why I enjoy doing these transcripts so much. Off to work on number 159. Wow, Palumbo looks really intriguing. And dang, he went to my alma mater, Pitt. All the bestest, Susan." Well, Susan, you are the bestest. Thanks for those wonderful comments. And hey, we'll keep knocking them out. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And hey, we're running out of emails. I'm all caught up. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. Alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo. You'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. That's what Sarah Hanna Ratcliffe did. That's how we got her voice message. And, you know, I love receiving those. Thanks again to Steve Riles, author of Drunk with Wonder. Be sure to hang around for the Jeff Smith song, Ones and O's, coming up in just a moment. My next guest will be Shrink Wrap Radio listener, Randy Clare, who is a licensed acupuncturist and hypnotherapist and NLP practitioner in private practice in Seattle, Washington. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Switch off the screen when they start getting mean. It's only silly words from someone you've never heard of. Don't cry about it. There's no use about it. Everybody knows it's only ones and O's. That's the way it goes today. Everyone repeats, so you can just delete. It's just another game, just like yesterday. Turn off the sound when the hating starts. there's always someone that loves to say they're the right ones. Anyway, turn the comments off. Just turn and cough. Everybody knows it's only ones and O's. That's the way it goes today. Everyone repeats, so you can just delete. It's just another game, just like yesterday. Yesterday.